My name is Michael Coates. I'm a former firefighter, but I'm also a former soldier. And it's the stories from the individuals within this military community that I'm desperate to document. Ordinary soldiers can achieve extraordinary things. Our next guest is an example of this. He's a best-selling author, entrepreneur, has worked in TV. He has taken charity fundraising to an extreme level. From Blackpool to Running Dangerously, Episode 9, Jordan Wiley. This is Declassified. Jordan, we needed a bit of positivity in this podcast. The last couple have been a pretty brutal, and I know we're going to get a good account from and a different angle actually to the other podcast, which I think we needed really. Born in Blackpool.
Very proud of that as well.
Yeah. What was childhood like, mate, growing up in...
Yeah, it was, you know, I come from a working class family. I was brought up on quite a rough council estate in Lancashire, but certainly had a... wasn't the toughest of upbringings. I guess when wherever you come from in life, whatever you experience growing up as a child, that's what normal and that's what life is. Mm. But no, you know, really proud of my Blackpool roots, and had great parents. My father was served in the Royal Marines, had a full career there. My mother had various jobs, but I couldn't have asked for two better role models. They taught me what, you know, working for a living was about, and if you want anything in life, you've got to be prepared to sacrifice and go and achieve it. So I've got no complaints, or you know, it wasn't privileged by any means.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I went to very very normal schools, grew up on a council estate, and just cracked on like most people do.
Do you look back on it now and take kind of value from it and think at the time I didn't appreciate that, like the work ethic, or you know, like your mum going out and you know, putting a shift in, so to speak, and.
Yeah, I think as a child you take a lot of things for granted, and it's something that certainly being a father myself now, having a daughter, and that's why, you know, a lot of the charity work that I do is focused on child-centric, on people with no opportunity in weird and wonderful parts of the world in foreign lands. And I think that for me, going back to places like Iraq, Afghanistan, and anyone who's been in the military, I think one of the things that you leave those sort of places with is that sort of lasting memory of the people you meet, but more so than ever, the children.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we're not there yet, but we're definitely going to cover it. And yeah, growing up, so we had... especially with your dad, with the values that like the Royal Marines taught him, and I'm sure he taught you, which you've just kind of suggested then. So why did... Well, it was obvious then, wasn't it? He was going to join the Royal Marines.
Do you know what? I went and did my potential Royal Marine Commando course and successfully passed it. And then I had about a three-month break where you're sort of waiting around to hear back from him. And, you know, at that time, we were in a very different... sort of situation from a recruitment than we are today, where numbers are very low. You know, when I sort of joined the military 2000, 2001, you know, people were queuing up to join the military, and there was no Iraq, there was no Afghanistan, and I guess it was a bit of a jolly at the time. If you like playing sport, if you like traveling, that was the initial attraction for me. But why did I join the military? Probably not. I didn't have any pressure from my father or my grandfathers or anybody like that, even though they all served in the military. I think for me it was a bit of I left school with no GCSEs. I had no qualifications, so I wasn't going to go into, you know, sixth form or university or anything like that, because the simply opportunity wasn't there for me.
Yeah.
You know, when you leave school with very little in terms of academic qualifications, you're quite limited in your opportunities. And the military was great because I could play football, I could go and see a bit of the world, and I could be a lad, which is what you want to do when you're 16, 17.
The thing as well, from the background, because mine and your backgrounds are fairly similar, it's almost seen as there's not that many routes out. So there's not that many routes out of Hull, there's not many that many routes out of Blackpool, but the military gives you a really...
Oh, it's perfect. And I'd recommend it to any youngster. You know, people say to me, would you let your daughter join the military? Of course I would, if that's what she wanted to do. I think it gives you the best grounding in life that, you know, that money can't buy. The values that you learn, you know, and 10 years after I've left now, they're still installed in me, the courage, respect, integrity, selfless commitment. You know, they're things that are ingrained in every aspect of my life, and I try and pass them on to people I meet when I talk in schools, assemblies. Them core values take you so far if you believe in them and you live by them.
Mate, I was with I was at the Royal Hospital Chelsea last week. I was chatting to a guy who'd just done national service, not just but but done national service, only a couple of years, and now in his 70s, still lives by those values. And just, you know, that kind of respect and everything else that comes with that. So you joined March 2001.
Yep.
So who did you join in the...
So I joined the King's Royal Hussars, the finest cavalry regiment in the land.
Other cavalry regiments are available.
Yeah.
And, yeah, good.
Oh, brilliant. You know, I'm very proud. I think that whatever cap badge, whether you're, you know, from engineering, from logistics, special forces, marines, paras, you name it, I think that it's so important to believe in, you know, what that cap badge and the history behind it stands for. And I'm very proud to still have very strong links to the regiment as a trustee of the sort of regimental charity museum and things. And I, like you and many others, I do my best to help those who are going through that same process of transition. But hugely proud, you know. For me, because of the process of elimination, when I joined with no qualifications, I had these sort of grand ideas of joining military intelligence or RMPs. No comment on them. I very quickly found myself, it was going to be on the front line. It was you're going in the infantry or you're going in the armoured corps, and you know, bombing round in 62 tons of armour sounded a bit sexier than carrying it round on my back.
Yes, for a 16, 17-year-old. Craving adventure, that's...
Exactly, driving a tank, there's no greater, you know, adventure or adrenaline rush than bombing across country, across Canada, on a, you know, the plains or whatever, in 62 tons worth of armour, 5 million quid as a 17-year-old, and you've not even, you know, you've only just got your Vauxhall Corsa or whatever it is at the time.
Yeah, so then we went, or you went on Telic, so did all your training, did all the big, got right into the regiment. 3 years later, you was in... Iraq on Telic 6.
Yeah, I went to Northern Ireland first, actually.
Oh, okay.
I did Op Banna, Northern Ireland, which, you know, it was, I guess, yeah, sometimes not embarrassed because I'm proud of my military service, but when I think of what people who'd served in Northern Ireland, you know, through the late 60s, 70s, early 80s experienced, you know, my experience and I guess anybody who experienced tours in the 2000s in Northern Ireland were very different, let's say. Very important, but very different. You know, I, you know, stood in a sangar in somewhere, you know, across McGlen, South Armagh, whatever, was a very different experience than someone who stood in that same sangar 20 years earlier.
It is what it is, though, and you can't do anything about time, and that's your situation with that, and that we've had Iraq and Afghanistan still to come.
Absolutely.
So it seems to be this wave of, and this generation's had it pretty intense.
Yeah.
So was you in essentially tanks then, or was you on
foot? No. I was on foot again. I was, you know, in a small search team. You know, it was all the usual sort of vehicle checkpoints, searching properties, searching houses, stop and searching people. Under the Terrorism Act 2000 at the time, you know, it wasn't, although there wasn't major troubles, the sort of geopolitical situation was still quite fragile. And when you're 17, 18 and you land in Northern Ireland, and the first things I can remember very clearly, landing at East Tyrone in a place called Dungannon, and we landed on the helicopter and this was like 2 days before Christmas. And the signs were, you know, don't group together, mortar attacks, be aware of the snipers. And I was like, bloody hell, you know, you think you're going into sort of Vietnam when you land as 17, 18 in Northern Ireland. But that sort of quickly wore off after about 2 weeks of studying a sangha, you know, 12 hours a day.
Yeah. I mean, look, these times of boredom in anything you do
and
downtime, but it's when you've got to switch on and protect people around you and as well as the local population and themselves as well. That's when that training really counts.
Yeah. But it was the first time, I guess, as well, I'd been away from home for, you know, for 6 months, a long period of time, and you learn a lot about yourself, you learn a lot about the other people around you, and actually it's you know, it's that sort of growing from a boy to a man, you know, the old cliche, because you are fending for yourself, you know, you're in the big wider world now, and you know, you can't just go home and see your mum and dad at the weekend. So it was definitely a worthwhile experience. And
what year was that then?
That'd have been 2002.
So pre-Iraq as well.
Yeah, literally straight out. In fact, we were watching in 2003. My tour went into 2003, and we were watching on the news, you know, in our sort of in one of our outposts in Northern Ireland. We were, I think it was in Clogher or Ochnacloy or somewhere like that, and we were watching it all, the invasion of Iraq, and it was like, you know, but yeah, we might be going there next. This is pretty serious now.
Here's one. Was you gutted you weren't there?
Yeah, I was, yeah. Yeah, I think everyone was, I think, weren't they? I think, but what, and it was quite frustrating because I was really delighted to go on a tour so early in my army career, because I literally left phase two training and was in Northern Ireland, you know, there was no sort of in between at the unit. I had to go and do a sort of catch-up NERT course at the time, a sort of Northern Ireland reinforcement training course, and it was like the fast track of what people would do for 6 months in about 3 days or whatever, yeah. All the sort of riot training and all that sort of stuff, which was cool. And I remember, all I remember thinking was, I'm going to have my first medal in 6 months, and I'm still young, I'm only 18. And then Iraq kicked off, and Northern Ireland, no one was interested in that medal anymore.
I remember the battle group was, the orders came out, and I wasn't on it. I was going to Canada or something. And I'm not going to say the name of the guy because I don't think he knows, but we were identical except he had two kids.
Right.
Same trade, same everything. So I went in and saw the troop commander and was like, any chance of me going on? Because he's got kids. And the next morning I was on parade. He's like, coach, you're going to Iraq. I was like, get in there.
Happy days.
And because everyone wanted to. It sounds daft now, but it was like the big adventure.
Yeah.
So I kind of sympathise. But year after, 2004, Talik 6, is that right?
Yeah, 2005.
Yeah.
Into 5, yeah. Yeah.
What was that like landing then? Because that's when...
Yeah, Talik 6, I remember very clearly, and I was very fortunate, actually, because I'd managed to somehow, by hook or crook, manage myself onto an intelligence collators course. And I did some courses in some incredibly interesting stuff in the intelligence cycle, intelligence analysis. I did my prisoner handler, tactical questioner, interrogators course, which opened up a new world for me in the military that I'd not seen being in an armoured regiment. Mm. That was probably one of the highlights of my career, Talik 6, because my tour was so interesting. It was just full of very, in fact, highs and lows. You know, some serious lows because of the people and the friends and colleagues we lost out there, which sort of stay with us today. But it was, I can remember sat there in the airport in Bryce Norton, and there was a Coldstream guard who tragically lost his life called Guardsman Anthony Wakefield. And the day I flew out, he'd lost his life. And I knew that I was going there, and it was sort of studying my mind. Alamara, you know, you're going to be there in 12 hours. And this guy, the tour's only been going on for a week, and someone's been hit already. Mm. And tragically, and I think it was an improvised claymore in central Alamara. And that really sort of hit home then that this is real now. This is not Northern Ireland, what you experience. This is not the training on Salisbury Plain. This is war now, you know, you're going into combat. And I think that is a real sort of, that's when it really hit me, when I saw Guardsman Wakefield, who would, because we was only a small outpost at Alamara as well, and we'd seen what people like Woody and Co on Talik 4, where, you know, Johnson Bahari got the Victoria Cross. I think the PWRR was the most decorated unit at the time after that, the tour, you know, in the 12 months before us. So I'd done a lot of research because of my job in intelligence as well. So I knew the area, I knew the key players, all the different militias, the different tribal leaders, and I was excited, but also very nervous as well, because it was a reality check, because I was going to be working as well with lots of different types of soldiers. So as an intelligence,
what was you doing then? So what was the actual job?
So my job was that I was an intelligence collator for a region. So I was specified a region in our sort of area operations, and my job would be to attach myself to patrols. Brief patrols going out on the ground on different aspects of intelligence, because a lot of in Iraq at the time, lots of the operations and the sort of counter-terrorism, counter-insurgency operations were intelligence led, so they relied on patrols picking up bits of information, data from, you know, meeting the tribal leaders, the warlords, looking at propaganda campaigns, looking at pattern of life, looking at the different patrol routes that people were taking, making sure we weren't setting, you know, patterns, all sorts of weird and wonderful things, interrogating prisoners or suspected terrorists, tactically questioning, using interpreters, working with local police, local authorities. It was an incredibly interesting piece of my career, because I think when you're on a patrol in the ground in a normal sort of conventional unit, you get told what your mission is that day and you go and do it. Whereas when you're sat in the sort of ops room or in the intelligence cell, you see the bigger picture, which is quite eye-opening at the time. And sometimes I used to think, God, if you knew what was actually going on the ground, you probably won't even want to leave the camp gates when you see the bigger picture. But such a fascinating role to work in military intelligence was, and it just opened up lots of different doors.
So you went with your...
I wore my cap badge, but I was attached to the Staffordshire battle group. So I was often on patrol with the Coldstream Guards, the Staffordshire Regiment, or the King's Royal Hussars. Whichever the sort of operations dictated at the time. But I had a lot of flexibility, which was
and
really
did the
good.
Did you do the full 6 months?
Yeah, I did the
with
full,
that,
full
in that
tour,
role.
In that role, yeah.
Good, mate.
Yeah, it was really good.
So finish that Talik. came back, and then not long after he decided to leave.
Yeah, I think Telic 6 was a tough time. You know, we lost some you know, we lost some incredibly inspiring soldiers out there. We lost three from the Staffordshire Regiment, who I happened to be, you know, on patrol with that day. Lieutenant Shearer, Private Hewitt, and Private Spicer, who again were in a contact in Alamara where we got hit. You know, and they're sort of the names. What I always when you lose people on operations, I think I sort of take it as a personal responsibility, as do most soldiers on operations, to keep their memory alive, which is, you know, why for me it's important to be telling you their names today. Mm. Because it's, you know, that's, we were there, we should tell their story. And you know, I do a lot of voluntary work at the Regimental Museum where I'm a trustee, and I tell Corporal Brackenbury, who lost his life on the 29th of May 2005, I tell his story to every person who walks through the museum doors, because I think we have a duty, a responsibility, and as a brother in arms, you know, we have to keep his memory alive, or anyone who's paid the ultimate sacrifice for the country. Mm. I think it's very important.
So they're with a kind of breaking that down then. So bit of a tough one.
Yeah, a bit of a tough one, and I just thought you've got to be more to life than this. You know, when you're putting people in body bags and attending funerals and carrying people onto planes or helicopters or whatever, you have a bit of a reality check, and you think. And I guess it is a bit knee-jerk reaction at the time. And I was very fortunate to have I worked under some incredibly talented leaders. You know, my squadron leader, Major Nick Hunter, my Sergeant Major Alex Rutter at the time. These were incredibly inspiring guys that, you know, held us all together. And one of the things that I remember the squadron leader saying, that along the lines of that, you know, the people who we've lost, they've now gone, and we will mourn them when we get back to the UK. But we have to continue, fight through, push through. We've got a job to do, and we need to make sure we look after the living as well, which, you know, you have spoke about a lot on this show previously, that it's the people who are living with the war wounds that you don't necessarily see that we have to keep an eye on and look after. So, you know, that's something that always stood out from that. I remember stood round Alan Brackenbury's you know, coffin with the Union Jack draped on it, and we had a real inspiring talk at the time from Major Nick Hunter, who was a squadron leader, and he sort of said, guys, this is, you know, this is part of being in a combat zone. You know, it's not good, but it is what it is, sort of thing, and we've got to keep working and stay focused on the task in hand. And at the time, you're thinking, bloody hell, that's a bit like, you know.
Gosh.
But yeah, we.
Well, if you don't, there's going to be more.
If you don't, there's going to be more of them. There's going to be more of you guys that are going to get hit. And unfortunately, whether we like it or not, casualties are part of war and part of combat, as we know.
So you've gone from that kind of high octane, I suppose, then leaving. Did you go back to Blackpool?
Yeah, I went back to Blackpool, and I found myself working. Initially, I was waiting to go in the police, and I had a very, very short stint in the Lancashire Constabulary. I didn't really enjoy it at all. Actually, I had this sort of perception that the police would be very similar to the military, in terms of, you know, how they think, how they work. And I'm not saying that they're not, but from my experience and what I experienced, it was a very different organisation that was led in a very different way, with different values, different ethics. Not necessarily negative or bad ones, but just very different than what I understood from the military.
Like what?
I don't know. I think. You know, I think that
it's not good or bad, by the way.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, it's not. It's not a criticism. But I think in the military, we live and breathe by teamwork. I think, you know, that is, we appreciate and value every member of a team, regardless of what their role might be. And my experience of the police, and I'm absolutely not everyone's experience, but my experience was that the police was a job. Where the military is a lifestyle. You live and breathe 24 hours a day, you know, DPM, you live in it, you live with the people, whereas the police, you go home at the end of the day. And I found that the police was very more individual, sort of career orientated. You know, every person looks after their own career and they progress in their own way, whereas, I don't know, the military for me was, you know, if someone messes up or anything, you cover each other, you know.
So it's a bit more independent than interdependent.
A bit more independent, yeah. I think that's probably the way. But that's great for some people, but it just wasn't the world that I thought it was.
You've been brought up by the military, haven't you?
Yeah, that's all I knew, from my father to being in the system myself. So it was just very different. And naturally, there's a lot of, you know, I'm police officers, I'll tell you themselves, there's an incredible amount of paperwork. You know, I'm a hands-on person. I'm not the sharpest with, you know, sort of dealing with documentations and all that. I like to get stuck into something, and I think there's a lot of politics and a lot of paperwork. Any police officer will tell you that.
So, you then left the short stint there, then left.
Yeah, left very quickly, and I was I had these sort of grand ideas that I was going to go into the private security sector. I was thinking, you know what, I've seen guys working in weird and wonderful places, and in, also in the UK, earning ridiculous amounts of money to go and protect to be bodyguards protecting celebrities. And I thought, that looks like a bit of an easy ticket. I've done my time, I've been in the military, done a couple of tours, I'll jump on that. But it wasn't the case. You know, that world in 2005 was dominated primarily by former special forces personnel. It was a tough industry to crack, or you know, what we would consider elite, you know, the sort of Royal Marines, the paratroopers or whatever, elite units. So for me it was a non-starter. I couldn't even get a look in. I was sending my CV off everywhere. So much to the entertainment of my regimental career management officer, I rang him up one day. Mark Collins, his name was Captain Mark Collins. He was an LE, and a late entry officer. And I rang him up and I said, "Sir," I said, "I need to get back in the regiment." And he had a little chuckle to himself and he said, "Jordan, you know, leave it with me." And I think about 6 weeks later, it was quite funny because I had sort of a period where I had to get a job because I still had a mortgage and bills to pay and things. Yeah. I was living in a little sort of terrace house in Blackpool, and I had to pay the bills, and I was working as a security guard in that sort of interim period, and my job was working on the big Tesco Express in Blackpool, and my job was on the barrier, you know, and take nothing away from anyone who works as a security guard on the barrier. But it was 12 hours a day, 6 days a week, and it couldn't even cover my rent and bills, it was a real tough time, actually. It was quite a low period. And it was...
Is that because... Sorry, mate, to interrupt. Is that because you weren't planned properly when you was in?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I can remember on my resettlement leave, I was in... I think me and one of my friends, Scotty, we went to Magaluf when we should have been, you know, doing our career transition partnership. We were in sort of Falaraki and whatever else at the time in, you know, 15
good
years
experience.
Ago. Yeah, exactly, yeah. Which was my sort of, you know, being on that Tesco's barrier was probably a reflection of my choice of resettlement at the time. But, you know, I believe I was the best Tesco security guard that they'd ever had on that barrier. My job was only to lift it up for the cars coming in and out, but I polished that barrier every morning and I made sure I was good at it. But it was, what the ironic thing was as well, is my first job back in the regiment was guarding the front gate on the same barrier, the same red and white barrier.
Yeah.
But I was so much prouder because I had my berry back
on.
So rejoined
2006.
Yeah.
And then what was life like then? Did you have a different approach to,
completely,
to kind of,
you know,
military life?
I sort of, you know, the first time I was in the military, you just rolled with things and you was part of the system and you did what you was told. And, you know, I think I always say to young recruits who join the military that it's a bit like a game, the army. You know, you turn up on time, in the right place, clean shaven, wearing the right uniform, you'll smooth through your career without any problems.
Yeah.
It's only when you try and challenge the system in some way or challenge the authority of something that things start going pear-shaped for people. So for me, it was for the first stint in the army, I just did what I was told, cracked on. I wasn't a prolific soldier in any way. I consider myself just someone who played the game. I was good. I wasn't excellent, but I was good. I played football, and I think if you play sport in the military, that'll always carry you a long way. You know, even if you're only half good at being a soldier, if you play for the regiment or play for the army or the corps, just that alone will get you your first promotion in the system. Whether people agree with that or not, I don't know. But
I agree.
Yeah. And then from coming in the second time, I was very much focused on, I need a plan. So I was always going to leave again, but I needed to leave with some tools in my, you know, in my toolbox. I needed to square myself away, so to speak, in military terms. So I enrolled straight away in the first 2 months of being in the army on a foundation degree course with the University of Leicester in security and risk management. And I remember at the time people were saying, well, what do you want to do that for? Bloody hell, you know, you're in the army. And I just signed up for another 4 years, whatever it was, because it wasn't like I was going anywhere in a hurry. And even my Sergeant Major at the time, he was like, ideal, you're not gonna have any weekends, you're not gonna have any evenings. But I'd been on the other side now, and the grass wasn't greener. And I think there's a bit of a mentality, or I certainly had it when I left the army the first time, that the world owes you a favor, but because you've served your country and you've done a bit, that it shouldn't be that hard to get a job, which is not the reality. You know, you're just another cog in the system again when you get out.
No one owes you anything.
No one owes you anything. But I think I approached it with, someone's going to give me a job.
Yeah.
You know, I've just done a couple of tours. Yeah. You know, serve my country, wore my berry or whatever.
Everyone will be jumping at it.
It was far from the case.
Yeah.
You know, don't get me wrong. If there's an ex-military guy working as an ops director or a CEO, he might give you a trial or a chance. But generally, 99% of people, you know,
we'll get on to that in a sec. But you've dumbed yourself down a little bit because 1 second, you know, literally 2 minutes ago, you're saying you're not good at paperwork. Next thing, you're on a degree course.
Oh, it wasn't easy though. You know, it was one of the toughest things. So I actually tried to enrol on a bachelor's degree course, and the University of Leicester rejected me because I didn't have any academic qualifications. I didn't have any, you know, English, math, science, A to C, any of that sort of stuff. So they said, you're going to have to do an 18-month foundation course, and then you can go into your bachelor's. And at the time, I didn't even probably think I was going to go on to my bachelor's because, you know, every assignment was like, oh, it was ninja trying to get through it. I remember, you know, working to the 11th hour on everyone. I was the last guy to send in my work. And but actually, when I started to understand security and risk in a different way, and when you can understand it and the process and the cycle behind it, and then you can implement it into your day-to-day military life, because that's all you are. You work. If you're in the army, you're working in security just at the highest level, really. And when you can sort of realise that and put it into context, you just compliment.
And you're almost niching as well, aren't you, by doing these degrees? What else did you do then? So let's go through.
Yes, we did the foundation degree.
Yeah,
that allowed me then to go on to the bachelor's degree.
While you're still in.
While I was still in, yeah. And then as I left, I went on to my master's in maritime security and the sort of counter piracy aspect. But it was great value as well, because with all those, with your sort of thesis and your dissertation, I was working with industry on the outside to say, what do we need to know about, you know, what so I looked at cybersecurity quite heavily. So cybersecurity in the maritime
then,
sector. So I was looking at emerging, so it started with emerging threats. You know, I was looking at the Islamic State, you know, what IS posed, the threats. I was looking at cybersecurity. I was looking at lots of different aspects of because I was looking at what's next,
you know.
And that was from a military perspective at the time. It was, you know, what from being in the army. Because one of the things with the enhanced learning credits, the only way you can ever use them while you're still serving and not sort of signed off part of resettlement is that if they benefit the army.
Sorry, mate, just go closer to the...
Sorry.
Comfort. No, it's cool, mate. It's cool.
Is that right?
Yeah. It's not your fault. It's just the distance.
No worries.
Yeah.
My dodgy Blackpool accent.
Yeah, that's it.
So one of the things that you don't sort of get told in the military is that with your enhanced learning credits, the only time you can ever use them while still serving, not signed off, is if they have a direct benefit to the armed forces.
All right.
Which is why security and risk management is perfect, because it's what you're doing for a living.
So what we're talking about here is, for those who don't know, when you're in or when you're out, or when you get out, you're given so much money, and when you're in some time as well, to basically enhance your qualifications and develop yourself. You kind of went about it not an orthodox way.
Yeah, so most people will do that when they leave or when they're about to leave. I did it for my whole career in my second stint.
Yeah.
I think that the best advice, you know, people always say the 7 P's, don't they? The prior preparation, planning. Mm. But I think that's the best thing you can... You've got to be planning for the outside, not when you sign off, but every day. You know, when you're in, start building your profile, start looking at opportunities. Where do you want to be in 5-10 years' time? Because, you know, when people leave, they have that knee-jerk reaction, right, I better jump on a course. And I see people doing lots of, you know, let's say the same courses. Everyone jumps on the same classics, and I've done it before. You jump on the courses and you go with the flow, but that's not necessarily where the opportunities are, where you're going to get a job, because there's been hundreds of thousands of people who've done that route before you and not been successful. So how are you going to be different and be successful?
Yeah, and that's it. You know, I just mentioned it then, and I'm a firm believer in it. You get to a point where you're niching into something really, really, really specific, and the rest of it will kind of look after itself.
Oh,
you've only got a small pool of that niche, and you're going to earn money afterwards as well.
Yeah. Well, I think as like a junior NCO, I remember someone saying to me, going, you know, if you're an officer, or certainly an officer in the cavalry, by default, you've normally got a degree anyway before you even join, because you've been well educated. You know, you've been at a higher academic establishment, you've been educated. But as a junior NCO, as a Lance Corporal, if you can leave into civilian life, we've not only, you know, 5-10 years experience, but that is then topped off with a bachelor's or a master's. That's putting you light years ahead of your competition.
Mm.
You know, and you don't find many privates, troopers, lance corporals leaving with a master's degree from the army. It's becoming more popular, but that was, for me at the time, a differentiator. To have those in my locker allowed me to sort of put my head up above the parapet and say, do you know what? I've done my tours as well, but also I can complement all that with a wider understanding of risk at an academic
sort. It's a good example of what you can achieve, and not just, you know, focus on the here and now, but the future. But did you, because you said it a second ago, did you also create a network outside? Not a non-military network or a former military network outside. So when you left, because you knew you was leaving, you could almost go and start connecting with people again.
Yeah, so I was attending events, conferences. I was making sure that anyone who left while I was still serving was remaining in touch with me. You know, for me, I love my quotes, as you probably see on the social media and things, but one of my favourite expressions or quotes is that a wise man learns from his mistakes, but an even wiser man learns from other people's mistakes. So I was just extracting information, wanting to talk to people who'd left, who'd been through that cycle. What mistakes did they make? What were the positives? What were the pros, the cons? And just milking everyone for information. And yeah, it was. I do probably once or twice a year an exercise that I call network mapping, where I'll put all the business cards out and I'll put them over the top of an overlay of a map, and I'll put everyone where they are in the world, what they're doing, and then I'll look at my own objectives. Where do I want to be, and how can I work with these people to get to where I want to be? You know, I think it's
a switched on approach, right? And people hopefully will understand why you do that. A network is essential. That's not you just taking, because people are also coming
to
you.
It's the opposite.
You're very outgoing and you go and help people as well, don't you? So your network should be you trying to reach out and help that person.
Yeah.
And then once you're outgoing and not just take, then opportunities start.
I think human nature, people have a tendency to only go to people when they want something, and it's one of the worst traits you can have, you know. And normally, typically, it's a job in this sort of transition world. Mm. Have you got any jobs going, or can you put my CV on that desk, whatever it might be? But there's a gentleman, and a real good book actually for any of the listeners. There's a gentleman called Keith Ferrazzi, a New Yorker who I met many years ago, and I went to one of his events, and he said to me, Jordan, the currency of real networking is generosity and not greed. And you know, if you can put yourself out there to help people, to connect the people together, that will take you a long way in life.
And you need influence, and you need something to give as well. And our guys and girls who are leaving, they are sat on this value. And it's people like you, and when you're talking about it now, they have to realise what value they're sat on and how they can help someone else.
Yeah.
So I'll just move us a little bit. So we are leaving the military 2009, you get a phone call from a friend, so part of that network.
Yeah.
The piracy stuff in the Indian Ocean and around that kind of that area is kicking off, the Somali pirates and whatnot. Take us from there.
Yeah, so the, you know, Somali pirates, I guess like most people, you know, pirates for me were quite far-fetched when someone said, do you want to come and sort of fight the pirates? You know, I'm thinking Johnny Depp, Pirates of the Caribbean, wooden leg, eye patch, parrot on the shoulder, like my daughter would do.
Yeah.
Obviously, that wasn't the case. I got a phone call. I'd never been on a ship in my life, and I got a phone call saying, "Do you want to come and join a security team? We're going up and down the coast of Somalia, and we're going to pay you a load of money." to do it at the time, it was a bit of a boom. It was the gold rush.
Yeah.
There was people leaving the military to get out just to do this. You know, the Royal Marines. I remember seeing an email in the Royal Marines internally that someone had sent me, and it was basically saying we're losing manpower very quickly to this sort of piracy phenomenon off Somalia. And there was opportunities were coming from everywhere, but it was one of the challenges. It was very unregulated as well. You literally didn't need any qualifications. You just literally jumped on a ship with a gun. Probably a weapon that you've never heard of, never seen before, and you was expected to stand on the bridge. So, but then you had army people from the army like myself who didn't know the port from the starboard at the time, you know, different terminology. Those who worked at sea, you know, firing from an unstable platform to an unstable platform is a very different concept than working in Iraq or Afghanistan. So
that's if essentially a vessel that's carrying cargo, whether it's oil or whatever.
Yeah.
Security guys, British essentially, or I think some Americans and whatnot as well, they were on these ships acting as security in case they were hijacked by pirates.
Exactly that, yeah. So the concept was, you know, a lot of people fail to realise that 95% of world trade is still done on the ocean. You know, everything, you know, from the coffee beans in our Costa cup here to The food we eat, the drink, the electronics, the iPhones, you name it, at some stage in its lifespan, 95% of everything that we use in the UK has come across the ocean, normally from places like China, Taiwan, you know, and so forth. And energy supplies coming out of you know, places like Qatar, Kuwait is no different. So for them to get from the Far East or the Middle East into Europe, they need to go through the Gulf of Aden, up the Red Sea, through the Suez. And That basically, they need protection to make sure they get through there.
Yeah, mate, it's, you became quite a figure really in that area of that niche area, you know, that maritime security, and you very quickly started going up the kind of very deregulated ranks, I suppose, and you became like a team leader on board. And who was working around you at the time? Was it all Brits?
Yeah, at the time, so the gold standard in 2000 and sort of 8-9, that was, you know, it was, I think it started as, you know, if you wanted 4x SAS guys, that was, you know, that was the platinum service.
Yeah.
And then it was sort of, you know, 4x British military, and then as the years progressed, it was one British military team leader, three Indian, ex-Indian Navy, then it was four Indian Navy, then it was one Indian team leader, three Filipino, and as the market changed, the conditions changed, and the service levels changed, and that was something, we saw the same in Iraq in 2003, 4, 5, but in the maritime sector, it sort of happened a lot quickly, that boom and the change in the market conditions. But yeah, I sort of, people, when you talk about maritime security, most sort of ex-military people think piracy straight away, because that's the sexy subject. But actually, there's a lot, you know, it's only a drop in the ocean, excuse the pun, you know, 1% of maritime crime is probably piracy. There's the refugee crisis, there's counter-terrorism, in, you know, there's naval, there's Coast Guard issues, there's border control issues. So for me, I started looking at the wider sort of aspects of maritime security and sort of went right of arc a bit. And that is where I started to see new opportunities, because I'd got the experience in the industry, but then I needed to evolve and develop that.
It's a good example of not looking at the here and now. And it's a good warning to people when these boom industries come in, especially with the security, because Phil, in episode 3, he says you're the first ones to get cut.
Yeah, absolutely,
You know, you get cut first off. So to look external, which is why you then set up a training company, because you saw this, you know what, this is not my life forever, although I'm having a good time earning some cash now, it's going to drop
ships
off.
As well was a perfect time to study. You know, you sat in a cabin, you've got no internet, no phone calls, Wi-Fi, anything like that. You know, you can only watch so many DVDs or do whatever else you want to do in your cabin. So you would, you know, studying was perfect. It was, you know, 12 hours a day. I had free doing nothing, and I was getting paid by the company that was employing me. So that was, I pretty much did my master's degree in maritime security.
Oh, so you carried it on?
Carried it on,
All right.
Into the shipping industry.
Yeah.
And I was speaking to the captain every day on watch, or the officer. So I was learning about the maritime world and you know, and how international trade, the logistics.
Perfect,
it was the perfect time for me to study maritime.
Can we talk about the training then?
Yeah, absolutely,
So you set a company up with what? What was the vision of that company?
So the concept was, you know, the company at the time was called the Training Wing, and the idea was that, you know, having worked for a very short stint in the police and worked in the army for nearly 10 years, we all know that both of those sort of organisations have a training wing. So I was sort of trying to take a brand or a name that everyone was familiar with and build a company. And the idea was that if you needed training, you would come to the Training Wing, and we did all sorts, from defensive driver, maritime security, close protection, first aid, you know, combat medical stuff, and we had some huge contracts, and they all linked back to that network again, because I remember the first contract or first major contract that I was awarded was in Iraq, and it was actually from a former commanding officer who I'd been his driver for 7 years earlier. You know, and me at the time, typical military, bloody hell, I've got to drive the colonel today or something. It was a dead-end job at the time. But he was building relationships. You know, I was sat in a car with him 12 hours a day for 2 weeks. You become a person that he can trust, that he can confide in. You listen to you're exposed to conversations that he's on the phone to you know, the commanders of the army, the CGS, and whatever. So one thing you learn quite quickly, you know, whether it's your love life, whether it's your business life, is that relationships and trust and integrity underpin everything. You know, you don't go anywhere in life without being able to build relationships.
Yeah.
And I think that's something, from a networking perspective, from a love life, from a business, whatever it might be, that trust it's everything in a relationship. And if you can't trust people, you can't really work with them, or I can't anyway.
No, and it's something I think I've probably done it on here, but bang on a lot. You know, when you start aligning values and you believe what I believe what you believe, no matter where you're from, that's when the trust starts.
Absolutely.
And if it doesn't, then it's just never going to be there. I'm going to move us a little bit. She did a few things, you started consulting, and I think you did the Captain...
Phillips film. With Tom Hanks. Yeah,
so he was like...
Yeah, so incredibly... Do you know when you meet someone who you've sort of watched all your life as well, and you're sort of hoping that they're a nice person?
Yeah.
And he was as well. What an absolute gentleman. So, really? You know, he was everything that you would see and hope for, and even more. Sometimes you meet people who are in the public eye, and you think... You know, I hope you are really like that in real life.
He speaks really highly of you as well, actually.
I've heard that.
Yeah. And
brilliant.
Yeah. I want to push us through the maritime stuff, but need to say you set the company up, sold the company, but we're still very much part of the consultancy side of things, and you still are today. You still consult today. Do you think you'll always be there in that sector?
Yeah, I think I'll certainly always have a hand in that sector. Firstly, because I enjoy it, I'm passionate about it, I understand it, I have a lot of friends, colleagues, network in that area. But it's very interesting as well. You know, I do a lot of work with the Djibouti government, one of their sort of maritime security advisors. 10 years ago, I didn't even know where Djibouti was. You know,
where is it?
It's a small country next to Somalia and Ethiopia in the Horn of Africa. But bizarrely, it's got the largest American military base outside the States there. It's got British Royal Navy there. It's got the Italians, the Chinese, the Japanese. Because it's one of the sort of very few countries in that region that's pretty much completely stable. You know, it's a fully functioning, stable country. When you look around it, a stone throw away, you've got Somalia, you've got Yemen, Eritrea, Sudan, South Sudan, Saudi. You've got some very unstable or politically unstable countries. So
lots of refugees as well.
And lots of refugees. And Djibouti is a safe haven in the middle of all that. And it's also a stone throw away from Iraq, Afghanistan. So it's a great sort of FOB, a forward operating base, if you like, for military operations.
So that side, so that's the East, isn't it?
Yeah, that's East Africa, yeah.
You spent some time in an hospital.
I did, yeah. Done your research, haven't you?
Yeah. Just tell me about that. Because it's funny, not funny, right?
So it definitely wasn't funny for me.
Yeah, the scenario is almost comical, but it's not. Go on.
So I was doing a documentary at the time with an American TV production company called Vice. I think they do a bit in the UK now as well. And they sort of, Vice specialise in really cool sort of production company, that their sort of strapline is something along the lines of that we'll go where nobody else wants to, or something like that. And Vice, I went out, I took the founder of Vice in the US out to the Horn of Africa to have a look at how weapons are moved around, how pirates operate, you know, what are their tactics, what are their procedures. And we went out to sea for 2 weeks. And the last couple of days when we were coming back in, the founder of Vice at the time, he kept getting seasick, you know, and I was sort of laughing and joking, as, you know, military banter, taking the mick out of him. And the last 2 days of the 2 week trip, I started going down a bit, feeling a bit funny, and he obviously was loving it because the sea was a bit calmer now. And he was like, I knew you'd get seasick as well, trying to tell me you're some old sea dog, you're getting seasick now, aren't you? And I was like, no, I'm not seasick. Anyway, get back into the port in the Horn of Africa, and my legs just buckled from underneath me, and I was like, bloody hell, what's going on here? Like, this isn't right. Anyway, cut a long story short, I'm put in hospital for the next 2 weeks with dengue fever, which is a sort of mosquito-borne virus. But it was a severe dengue, which is the sort of four strains of dengue, and I got the one where, you know, quite a few people have died from it. So it went from sort of a bit of a laugh and a joke to quite serious. But what was even more sort of comical, I guess, was the fact that they put me on this was when the Ebola crisis epidemic was going on in Africa, and they put me on an Ebola ward in quarantine. So I've got I'm in a tent, I've got the white suits around me, you know, and I'm looking, I feel like I'm on my deathbed on my way out, and you don't know what's going on. Nobody speaks English, you know, in Djibouti. It was all French speaking or Arabic. Yeah. And it was a pretty scary time, actually.
Yeah.
But what was incredible about, you know, I don't know if you're aware, but last, you know, over a year ago now, I got diagnosed with epilepsy. I had a seizure, and it all traced back to this dengue fever episode, which was, you know, I didn't even know that this was something that could happen.
Why is it something to the brain then?
What, yeah, I don't even know, understand it all properly, but we only found out through advanced blood tests and the MRIs and the CT scans and all that. But yeah, it must trigger something somewhere. But that is linked. I think 1 in 250 cases of people who've had dengue go on to have epilepsy, they tell me.
Oh, really?
Which is, yeah, very, very strange.
How are you doing now then with that? I'm moving us forward a bit, but how are you doing?
Oh, yeah, no, I'm all right. I had me sort of my seizure things last year, but I've not had any. I'm a year free now, so I'm allowed to apply for my driving license and all that again. I can drive again now, which is good news, because that was, I guess, the only real inconvenience. But
yeah,
to be honest, I got a bit fitter, bought myself a dog, went walking, went running a lot more. So yeah, I didn't really have any. Yeah, it's not really hindered my life in any way. I think perspective and outlook is a big thing, and attitude. And you know, I'm an ambassador for Epilepsy Action, the largest charity. So I try and sort of spread that message that just because you got epilepsy, you know, you can still achieve whatever you want.
Your positive attitude is something that I've been drawn towards, even when we didn't kind of know each other, and I saw you on social media and part of that kind of military community on there. And that was really what draws a lot of people to you, actually, that positive. But it's not always been positive, and I'm not going to go really into it, but we've had a long-term relationship with your partner, which because she was away a lot, was damaged and it broke down. You had your daughter, and that must have been a tough time for you, because you were, I know you're a great dad, and how did you?
Yeah,
we've really glossed over it. Sorry, mate, but you know, like, I wanted to get that positivity.
We're staying positive.
We are going to get positive now. So look, because I know it was a tough time for you.
No, it was. It was a very, probably the lowest point in my life, you know, and I've got no shame in saying that I still have medication I was diagnosed with severe depression 3 years ago, anxiety with severe depression, and it's something I share and talk about. And that's not from military or combat or PTSD or anything like that. It's from general day-to-day life things that go on in the world that every person out there experiences, you know, relationship breakdown, separate from the mother of your child or the father. And it's something that these things happen. Nobody wants them to happen. You know, we all want to live that perfect life where you meet your partner, you settle down, have a family, and you all live ever happily ever after. But, you know, sometimes you end up on different paths and the relationship breaks down. And for me, it was very tough. I'd spent 10 years with my partner. I got an 8-year-old daughter. And to then have that family home break down, and it wasn't because we hated each other or anything. Nobody cheated on anybody. There was nothing that. It was just that I'm away all the time and I'm doing this and I'm on my little. I sort of used to get, and probably still do sometimes, that tunnel vision. Whatever the project is, I'm 110%. I'm never half-hearted. If I do something, I do it to the best of my ability. And the lesson I take away from that is I didn't do that in my relationship, and I take not all responsibility, but I take a lot of the responsibility for the breakdown in my relationship. I was so focused on my career, on what I wanted to achieve to give them a good life as well, you know. And it didn't work out. And I remember one day I was, you know, my missus, or my ex-missus, sorry, she decided, Jordan, she'd give me enough warnings, and she said, I can't live like this anymore. You know, you sort of come in, you get changed, you wash your clothes, and then you're out the door again, flying off somewhere else. And she knew it wasn't a holiday. You know, a lot of it's charity work. It's doing whatever I do. And she said, and I came home one day and she said, that's it. You know, I'm going. I've warned you enough times. And she was a good woman, and I would never speak derogatory about the mother of my child. She's moved on. She's very happy now, and I'm delighted for her because she deserves to be happy. But, oh, it was very tough, you know, and for any sort of single parent out there, and you're on the other side sort of thing, for me, the toughest thing you'll ever experience is to see another person in your child's life. You know, for me, seeing my ex-partner's new partner on the in this social media world of Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and seeing your daughter maybe holding hands on holiday with another man, that's like somebody ripping your heart out. And I don't think that's something you can ever get over, but you learn to live with it. And actually, you've also got to sort of respect that not everyone's a bad person, although you might have a negative perception about them. They might actually be a very good role model. And
your daughter's getting brought up really well, isn't she? And she's well-rounded.
Yeah, she has a great family, a great surrounding. And as much as me and her mother have our differences and don't necessarily agree on everything, she's an awesome mother. And for me, that's all I can be concerned about, that she does her best for my daughter and I do my best. And although we don't speak often, or if we do, it's only about my daughter, we try and do our best. And
to parent, exactly. It's a really... what I'm getting, and we've had a brief conversation about this, and it's that it's more about you really, and how you still very much that hands-on dad, and would be there every minute of the day. Really,
oh yeah,
you
no, definitely.
You could.
Yeah.
But you know, it's working together. But you've also got to work on your own mental well-being as well,
and the
fitness
yeah.
side of things comes in, which is why these charity projects are so important. They're all what I'm getting is a lot of them are physical. Or what's the word? Physical based.
Yeah, yeah.
They're very much that side of things. You did one a couple of years ago called Barefoot Warrior, where you climbed Mount Kilimanjaro in bare feet raise some cash. The one you're doing right now is called Running Dangerously. Can you just tell? Because it's for me, like, this is an amazing.
Yeah, Running
project.
Dangerously is. I don't even know where I came up with this idea, but I think I was, you know, probably sat in a pub or whatever, having a pint with the lads, and I always try and be a bit different. You know, I try to think differently. I try to be a bit outside the box, and I think when you're in the business of fundraising or charity projects, there's so many of them. There's so many people out there doing incredibly inspiring things, and it's hard to be different. When, you know, everyone's been for a run, everyone's done a marathon, everyone's done a swim, climbed a mountain. So how do you do those but be different? So we did the Barefoot Warrior, which was a bit different and pretty painful. But then I wanted to go back to the places where I'd served or worked in the military. So I said, I come up with this idea, Running Dangerously. I'm going to go back to Somalia, Iraq, Afghanistan, and I'm going to run through those countries. And while I'm doing that, I'm going to go to orphanages, meet the children, and try and inspire a bit of hope and change some lives with the fundraising by sponsoring some education. And we did Somalia in February, did the half marathon in Iraq in May, and in about 4 weeks' time, I'm going to be flying out to Afghanistan to do my first ever full marathon, which should be interesting.
Oh, you're doing a full marathon there?
Yeah. And I've never done one before, so I don't know how I'm going to get on yet, but hopefully, for me, it's not about breaking any world records, it's about getting across the finish line.
Getting there.
Yeah. But no, I'm looking forward to it.
You're trying to raise 100 grand to put kids through their full education, aren't you, from start?
Yeah.
Is that the general?
Yeah, basically, yeah. Trying to raise £100,000 to put not just any children, but children who have lost their parents as a result of conflict and they still live in these countries. So most of them are orphans.
And super vulnerable, absolutely. Without education, and to give that hope to that next generation is really, cliche to say admirable, but I think when you've been to war and conflict, you experience that and you appreciate that how vulnerable those children are, then it's kind of a no-brainer. Like, it has to be something in you, isn't it? It's
not
like
a PR, especially as a parent as well. I think,
exactly.
I think my approach towards children has definitely, in fact, 100% changed since being a parent myself.
Yeah.
You know, people sometimes say to me, why don't you do it for a veterans know, charity or a campaign? And there's lots of people doing incredible things. But for me, children, they're always, you know, we go to war as soldiers or as adults. We know what we're doing. Mm. We don't expect to be casualties or our friends to be casualties or worse still, but children are just victims by default. They don't sign up for this. They're just there and they're part of the collateral.
They don't start a war, do they?
No, you know, there's no children who's ever started a war. That's for sure.
What's happening, really quick? Sorry to rush you.
No.
What's
no.
happening now? What's going? What's happening in the world of Jordan Wiley?
Lots. Obviously, Running Dangerously is on. We're training for that. We've got two very exciting projects for next year. Hopefully, bigger and better. I can't say too much at the moment because we're going to have a launch and things. But one will be from heights, and one might be on the water. So, really exciting projects with a bit of a dangerous twist to them as well.
Of course,
which which is good. Keeps us interested. Working with Bremont as a bit of a sort of what they call a Bremont Alley or a brand ambassador. Incredibly. They're an awesome organisation. They're doing some great stuff with the military. So there's my Bremont plug. Get yourself a Bremont timepiece.
Other timepieces are available. Mate, you've come at this at a different angle, and I would advise guys, especially if they're leaving, to see what you're doing, how you're doing it, and just piecing together your life and coming at it from a different angle, being very outward, and getting a lot in return, both with regards to business and also with regards to kind of your personal well-being as well. We're going to wrap up there, mate, and thank you so much for coming. Anything else to add?
Just I guess one final piece of advice, just to make sure we give value for the listeners, is I'm often asked, you know, for what advice can you give to anybody leaving the services, entering the private sector, and I always keep it simple, and I say use the ABC rule. Firstly, attitude. I think attitude is one of those things that will take you a lot further than any qualification, any amount of experience. You know, have the right attitude, keep an open mind. Secondly, build relationships everywhere you go. But remember, relationships are a two-way thing, not just when you want to get something. And see continuous professional development. You know, never stop learning, because there's opportunities everywhere, not necessarily obstacles. But absolute pleasure to be on the show, and thanks for your time.
Brilliant. We'll leave it there.